Welcome to Straight and Curly,
a podcast for self-improvement junkies.
I'm Kelly Exeter.
And I'm Carly Jacobs.
This is episode 65.
Hello and welcome to Straight and Curly. Today we're going to cover off a range of topics that don't need a whole blog post or podcast episode to cover, but they're just things that have been on the minds of our readers and listeners.
Yeah, so we recently asked members of, you know, our Straight and Curly group on Facebook what burning questions they had for us. And I also asked the same question of my A Lifeless Frantic blog readers. And actually, a lot of the questions of today are from those blog readers, and they're just questions that I didn't have a blog post worth of thoughts to offer to the questions. And also a lot of them I was like, oh, I wonder what Carly thinks of this. So that's why, yeah, it's a bit of crossover happening here. But yeah, there you go. Some of those questions are just cool and I was interested to hear your thoughts as well. So the first of those questions is how to get people to think for themselves. So Catherine asked this question in the context of being the person in her house that does all her kids' thinking for them, but it certainly also applies to, you know, partnered relationships and also workplaces. Carly, how do you get people to think for themselves?
So for me, like, I'm just going to come across as just the worst person ever, but I have to be very honest. For me, this comes down to other people inconveniencing me. So it sounds horrible, but if you waste my time, I will hate you a little bit forever. Legit, I just will. So my thing with letting people think for themselves is that I tend to let people make mistakes. So for instance, with kids, don't, if they're continually forgetting to take their excursion note, let them miss out on the excursion. It sounds really harsh, but you have to do it. So like once I gave my brother, when I was a kid, I gave him $2 when I was 4, and then I wanted it back. And my mum said I had to let him keep it because I gave it to him. And it was a harsh lesson, but it taught me to think carefully before I do stuff. And I do think that people need to make mistakes in order to learn from them. I am a bit of a bitch though, and I really don't mind watching people suffer the consequences of stupidity. I'm like, well, that was really stupid and I told you it was stupid and you did it anyway. So I'm just going to sit here and watch you suffer
in your jocks.
Yeah. Yeah. But also like, I mean, that may be hard for those of you that have souls, but yeah, that's where I sit on it. I'm like, well, that was really dumb. Deal with it.
And you see, so for me, like, because I'm a control freak, like I tend to do things for people so that they're done properly. And it's not that I don't like people making mistakes, but to me, it's so inefficient for people to make mistakes I know that they're going to make. So this is where I have to come from.
Just other people's crisis aversion.
Oh, I mean, it's so obvious to me when something's going to happen and then if it's going to cause me pain. So it's a bit like people go like, you know, Aunt will go somewhere without a jumper. And most people, and you, Carly, would go, let him go without the jumper. So when he's freezing his bottom off, like it's his own fault. But the thing is, when he's freezing his butt off, I'm kind of suffering as well because I have to listen to him complain about freezing. So what do? I go, take the jumper. I know that you're in, because Ant's like one of those really live in the moment. Like he takes living in the moment to the extreme. So he's in a nice warm house. It's warm in this moment. He's not thinking ahead 3 minutes to the fact that it might be 10 degrees outside and a jumper might come in handy. So I'm the one that, will go, no, just take the jumper. You may not think you need it right now, but who knows? You might need it in 3 minutes' time. So I really, I sympathize with Catherine because I have trained my family to let me do their thinking for them, and it's a very difficult thing to train them out of, and really the only way to do it is to take the Carly approach and let people make mistakes, let people suffer the consequences of those mistakes or of not doing things quite right. But at the same time, if you're like me and you would just rather things be done efficiently, then you have to I suffer the fact that people are going to make me do everything for them just because I like being in control. So it's a trade-off.
Yeah.
Number two is an interesting one from Leah, and she's asked, I'm interested in how to talk about money well. So she says, I grew up convinced that we had no money when we really did because my parents talked about having no money a lot, but I also don't want to overcorrect and overspend on my kids or create the opposite problem. So I have to say, I'm really weird about money as well. I like money and I like having money. And I think that a lot of that is because growing up, my parents also talked about having no money a lot. And the reality was we did and we didn't. So we always had enough for the necessities, but we had no disposable income. So like any kind of contingency really screwed things up financially for my family and especially for my mum because she was the one who managed all the money. So I, over time, have developed this massive scarcity complex about money in that if I'm not like making considerably more than I spend and if I don't have a sizable buffer in place to cover disasters, I feel like money is scarce when in no shape or form or anybody's life is money scarce in that situation. And when I'm in that scarcity mindset, I'll catch myself saying to my kids, no, we can't do that because we don't have any money right now. You know, and I catch myself doing it and I realize it's factually incorrect. And I kind of don't want the kids to grow up with the same complexes as I do. So I do change my words to, we're not going to do that because, you know, right now we're going to spend less money just for a little while. And I don't even know, that's probably not even the right thing to say either.
Oh, I like that. I think that's good.
Yeah,
I
don't want to, like the refrain of my childhood was, we don't have the money, we don't have the money, we don't have the money, which means like as an adult, I have massive complexes about money. And like I said, I don't want to give my kids that. But the other thing like that Leah mentioned is the overcorrecting thing. And the thing is like as an adult and certainly for all my kids' lives, like we do have disposable income. I'm a spender, not a saver, as you were kind of spun out to find out in the episode that we did about money earlier. I'll look up that episode number later. So I don't like spending money on stuff, but I do love spending it on experiences, you know. So if my kids want to go to the zoo, or if they want to do a holiday program, or if they want to go to SciTech, like I'm all for that and I will spend that money on that. But that means that like they've had unbridled access to those experiences, and I love giving them unbridled access to those experiences, but I'm also kind of subtly teaching them that they can do whatever they want whenever they want, which is probably not healthy either. So yeah, so and here's something I wanted to throw at you, Carls. Someone put on Facebook the other day, because I'm jumping around here, but the thing is I was saying is like we learn all these money behaviors from our parents. We grow up with these complexes. And isn't it crazy that something so crucial to being an adult and to functioning in, you know, the world as money, as good financial personal money management is not taught at school?
Absolutely. So I overheard when I was camping, I have a feeling I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I was camping and I heard this guy talk about how he bought a ute and it was like a $50,000 ute or something, and he bought it on finance or whatever you call it. Like, I don't even know what it's called because that's just not something that I was brought up doing. Like, you pay cash for things if you're a Jacobs, that's what we do. And this guy was saying, oh, and you know, by the time I pay it off, I will have paid twice as much for it. And you know, they're not doing you a favor, they just want your money. And this guy would have been 25. And I was listening to him thinking, why did no one teach you this? Why did no one tell you that it's a really bad idea to buy a very, very expensive car on credit and pay it off when it's depreciating and paying interest on the money that you've paid for the car? It just, I can see how people can fall for that kind of thing, but it was just, it was a shock to me that people didn't know that that was a really bad idea. Yeah, so.
Yeah, well, no, I was just going to say the whole reason I brought that up is because someone had posted on Facebook the other day, what's something that, you know, you wish had been taught at school but wasn't? And I was like, yeah, like the basics of money management, because otherwise you are kind of at the mercy of who your parents are and how they deal with money. And it's just something I'm very conscious of now as a parent myself. And how do I teach my, and this is something that was on Leah's mind as well, is like, how do you teach your kids to, you know, not be freaky about money and be respectful of it, but also understand it and Yeah, I just think it can cause a lot of really weird issues. So, yeah, like what are your weird issues about money, Carls?
Again, I'm also weird about money. I never wanted for anything growing up and I was certainly raised very middle class, but my parents were business owners. They ran a plumbing business, so every single cent that came into the house was through my dad's grunt work and my mum running the household like a goddamn champion. So the money you earn for yourself in your own business is very different to money that you get paid as a wage. And people don't really understand that until they've experienced both. It's very different money. I think honesty around money is definitely the best policy. It's important to explain things like credit, the difference between good credit and bad credit. So houses are good credit, cars are bad credit. And again, if cars are your chocolate and you love cars, go for it. But if you don't care about cars, I drive the biggest shit heap. And my dad is just like, when are you going to replace that car?
And you're like, why would I?
I'm not. I'm going to wait until it dies. So Ben and I bought my current car when we'd been dating for 6 months. He helped me buy it and we've been together for 11 years now. So that's how long I've had this car. And it's great. It's not going anywhere. It gets me around. I also think it's important to talk about credit cards and how it's a bad idea to use them as actual money. Mm. So I got my first credit card 2 years ago and I paid actual money for everything before then. So seriously, I spent most of my life not having a credit card and I only got one because I need to have a credit rating if I want to get a loan at some stage in the future. So I just don't do credit at all. Also, my mum was super honest about money growing up. And honestly, my parents probably could have afforded to have financially supported my brother more than they did. Not that I wanted them to, but I really appreciate that because I grew up in a middle-class kid in Canberra. So most of my peers, I went to a Catholic high school and most of the people I hung out with went to a very expensive private school. So a lot of my peers were sort of given new cars and their parents would pay for holidays for them. And they were lots of my friends have been given house deposits and things like that. So and my parents, theoretically, I actually don't know really if they could have afforded to do that, but they didn't. And I actually think that that's really great because why should they? It's not their responsibility to buy me a car. And I mean, to be fair, they did buy me a car, but they bought me like a $2,000, you know, shit heap laser that I ended up writing off in the rain one afternoon, but that's a different story. Yeah. And so I think that it's really interesting to see that my parents might have been able to do that and choose not to do that because it's their money and also they're business owners. So they have to fund their own retirement. My dad has no superannuation. I mean, he does now because he's, you know, working, but he has to put it all aside himself. And this was sort of before you were, so just sort of watching their whole thing around money has been completely fascinating. And it's actually taught my brother and I to be incredibly money conscious, very independent when it comes to money. And we value money hard. So I definitely don't think I'm weird about money, but I certainly haven't grown up with bad ideas about money.
Yeah, you have a very healthy, balanced mindset about money. And it's really interesting to me as a parent listening to you say what you're saying because, like, I just want to buy everything for my kids. I just, even though rationally I know this is, it's not setting on, you know, they're only like 8 and 4, like I'm not running for life just yet. And I'm not buying them Ferraris or anything, but I know that I will have to fight that tendency to want to do exactly what your friends' parents did, which was, you know, set them up as much as they can coming out of school, which is the same as you. Like I, very similar education actually, went to a Catholic high school, private school. Most of my friends' parents could afford to do those kind of things to them for them. My parents couldn't. You know, I worked as soon as I could work because that was the only way I could have any money to spend on myself and buy things for myself. And yeah, so it's given me a relatively healthy approach to, you know, not having credit and not buying things until you actually have the money to buy things for, you know, et cetera, like that. But yeah, I can see that if I'm not careful, I can set my kids up to not respect money the same way that kind of you and I do. So
Yeah, exactly. And Ben is very similar. His parents are identical. So Ben and I have partnered very, very well together in our view of money. And also I think that it's important to think about how the economy has changed and the availability of things have changed. So when I was a kid, if I wanted something that was really expensive, my mum would say, oh, look, you know, maybe we might get that for you for your birthday, or we might get you that for Christmas. Mm. The availability of things has increased now. So there's always a cheaper version of the thing that your kid might want, or there is a way for you to get whatever your kids want. So I think it's important to also include sustainability and buying well and buying once into discussions about money. And that's more important now than it ever has been because of how much crap is available now and how easy it is to buy cheap, shitty stuff. Yep. That has to be a part of the conversation now. And that wasn't an important part of the conversation when I was growing up because we didn't have that availability. So I think it's good to include that in there as well. So for instance, like when I was growing up, my mum would constantly talk me out of buying crap. So she'd say, don't buy those cheap fashionable shoes, save for a bit longer and buy a pair of Doc Martens that you'll wear for the next decade. And I spent, you know, it would have been $200 on a pair of shoes when I was 16. That was like 4 Saturdays at my news agency job. And it felt like someone was ripping out my heart when I spent that money. But I had those shoes for 10 years. I ditched them like 4 years ago. So, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it because I had them. They were falling apart. They were irredeemable. They had taken me all over the world and I got to throw them out. And I was like, I remember buying these and my mum paid for half of them. So she did that kind of thing. Like I'll pay for half of this thing if you can come up with the rest of the money for it. So it was always a learning experience around money. And I remember throwing them away and just feeling really warm and fuzzy and having this moment with this beautiful item that my mother and I had purchased together. And it had just brought me so much joy in my life. And it was kind of just like sending it off. And it was lovely.
Yeah,
it was really cool.
I love that. And I have one more thing to offer to this conversation before we move on to the next question is the one thing I have with my son, he's turning 8 this year, but for the past couple of years, he's often been given money for his birthday, and I've actually encouraged people to give him money rather than just random toys that he's going to play with for 2 seconds and then move on from. And the good thing about that is now if we go to the shops and he wants something, I'll say to him, well, you know, you've got your money there. If you think that that thing is worth spending your own money on, then by all means, go for it. But if it's only worth spending my money on, then, you know, you don't need
it. That's a great one.
Yeah, so that's been a really good one as well. Okay, so number 3, the third question is from Fiona, and she's asking about the woes of a freelancer, about how it never rains but it pours. She feels a bit frustrated by the need to take on all the work on offer and pretty much kill yourself in the process because you may not have any next month. And I know we have spoken about this or touched on this in a previous episode, but I do think it is always worth revisiting. So how do you deal with this, Carl?
I don't deal with this. I suck at this. I just always take all the work all the time. I spoke previously about my dad, and he instilled this hardcore Protestant work ethic in me, and earning money is a primary focus for both of us and always has been. He taught me never to take time off work unless I was at death's door.
Unless you were dead.
Exactly. Like vomiting blood is pretty much the only excuse to not go to work for him. So, and it's not that we're materialistic. It's quite the opposite. It's just that we both like to not have to worry about money. And I thrive when I'm busy. So I actually prefer having too much work than not enough. And I just realized I'm not helping at all. So basically my advice is to be a type A workaholic. Another thing that you could do in this situation is to see if projects can be pushed back to accommodate busy times. So I've had a few times where I've had to travel or I've had lots of projects stacking on top of each other. And I've said to some of my ongoing clients, is there any way that this project can be dealt with in a few months' time? Often they're more than happy to accommodate that. Another thing that you could do, which is so great, one of the best things I ever did, you could hire an overseas VA to do stuff for you that you don't need to be doing. So if your example, if you're a designer and someone's paying you $50 an hour to do design work and half of that job is literally just laying the same text over 100 different images, hire a VA to do it for like $9 an hour and then you work on the more important stuff. So a lot of the time, if you are a freelancer, people will just throw a whole bunch of work at you, a lot of which is way below your skill set, and you might as well pay someone less money to do that for you while you're concentrating on the other stuff.
Yeah, that's it. And I mean, it might take a little while to find that overseas person to help you, but once you've got them, you've got them and they're amazing.
I'm in love with mine. Yeah. She's beautiful. And I refuse to tell anyone about her because they can't have her. So don't even ask.
So there's a few ways that I get around this one. My favorite is having a few different sources of income. So like I'm the ultimate slashy. When everyone says to me, what do you do for work? I'm like, who am I talking to? And you might tailor my response to that. But the reality is I can make money from writing, from web designing, from graphic designing, from editing, from social media management, from consulting. So some of these things I like to make money from more than others. Some of these things are easier. Some of these ways are easier than others. But ultimately, I find it's good to be able to have a few different things to call on, because it means that if one is lagging, the other one might offer an opportunity. The other thing is, like, I have built quite a good email list now so that I know, and I've built out good networks. So I do know that right now, if I need to make a little bit more money for something, I can kind of throw it out there to my networks that say I'm available to do two web designs in the next month, you know, or I'm able to, I don't normally do consulting, but I'm currently available to do it just for this next month. And there's a little bit of scarcity in there as well, because I genuinely don't do consulting as a rule. So it might sound like, oh, that's so easy for you to say, Kelly, you've got these networks to call on, but I didn't always have these networks. And if you don't, like, and I'm not talking to Fiona specifically, I'm just talking to people in general, today is a good day to start building out your networks, because in a year's time, you'll be so surprised at how much bigger it is. But also you'll be so surprised to realize just how big your network is now. We just don't think about it in those terms. But when you have a look at, like, if I've found this so many times in life and I've told so many people to do this, tell people what kind of work that you want to do, and you will be staggered at if they are not available to give you that work themselves, but they will act as an unofficial sales force for you, and they will
absolutely
look for opportunities for you. I mean, I've had so many people say to me, like, just touch base with me and go, look, you know, if you see any writing opportunities out there, let me know, because I'm on the, you know, I'm on the lookout for this kind of work. And more often than not, within a week or two, I'm like, oh, hey, someone will ask me and I'll go, yeah, this person, she just let me know. Like, it's brilliant. So just let people know what you're available to. And it's that diversity, I find, that evens out the ebbs and the flows, and it, you know. And unfortunately, the whole raining thing where you're just drowning in work and you've taken on all that work because you're a bit scared there might not be more work, I think we kind of just have to make peace with that when you're a freelancer.
It is just a reality of freelancing, yeah. I think.
And that's it. The only way to eliminate that is to have like a steady source of recurring income. But I'm just finding that those kind of things are becoming less and less present in today and age. And yeah, the reality is, if we want the flexibility of our freelance lives, we have to put up with the fact that sometimes we're just going to have a lot more work than we can cope with, and we just have to make it happen.
Exactly. Like, for example, this week I had an editor write to me 2 days ago and say, oh, I've got a story that needs a really quick turnaround. Can you get it to me by Thursday? And, you know, I'm at the farm and I'm working and it's great. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to do it. But then I just kind of thought, you know what? Like, I've written over 100 articles for this person before, and I know how to do it, and it didn't take me that long, and it's really decent money. So I just sat in front of the TV and it took me a couple of hours, and I got Ben to proofread it and sent it off. And like, yeah, it ate into a little bit of my relaxation time that night, but who cares? Like, it was the whole reason why I freelance is so I can, you know, live at the farm for a month. Mm. Or I've done the same thing from Italy. So I mean, you kind of get the benefits of the freelance life, but you also have to take those moments. And also, I just like working anyway, so it yeah. doesn't really worry me.
Yeah, I do find, because I know, like, Fiona's got kids and I've got kids, and I do kind of sometimes feel myself being a little bit resentful that when, you know, an urgent job or a suddenly compressed workload situation means it's taking time away from my kids. But then I remember the fact that I got to drop my kids off at school every day last week.
Yeah, exactly.
And not be frantically running, you know, going, you know, why isn't the classroom open yet? I've got to be in the office at this time. Like, so, yeah, so it is hard, but it's also just a reality of the situation. We can do what we can, But I think that, that the freelance life's always going to be like that. So Jane asked about feeling like you're crap at something, and she put in brackets training, public speaking, presentation skills. She said, how do I know, you know, it's hard to improve or decide that it's not my bag and pursue other things? How do you cope with failure, disappointment, not living up to personal standards in the meantime? So how do you decide whether something's your bag or whether to pursue other things, Carls?
So I'm going to jump straight in there and say I'm really crap at the back end blog stuff, like not crap for a regular person. I'm pretty savvy if you know, I'm walking down the street and someone who, you know, is a nurse or something and not really needs to use a computer for their job, like I'm definitely better than your average Joe. But in terms of blogging, I am so crap. I think I'm actually the worst.
The least techie blogger.
I am so not techie at all. I try really hard though. Like that's the thing that makes me so sad about it. So, but honestly, like ask Kelly, ask my mate Kate from Secret Bloggers Business. She tells everyone constantly anyway. And Chrissy from Hair Romance, I'm terrible. They actually like, they bond over it when they see each other. They'll be like, did you know that like Carly doesn't know how to embed a form on her blog? And it'll be like, oh my God. So like, I want to be better at it, but I mean, it could take me an hour to get a button in the right spot on an email. And I just don't have time for that shit. It's just not my thing. I'm a master at drag and drop. So I've worked ways around this. So I get Ben or I'll pay a designer to create an email that I'm going to use, and I can drag and drop like a mofo. But if you want me to build something from scratch, I will cry. It's just, it's not my thing. But the thing is that I've accepted it. I'm a writer, I'm a speaker, I'm a community builder. I don't need to be a coder, web designer, computer whiz person. Other people can do that. It's just super annoying because I can't fix stuff myself. So I have to wait for Ben to do it, or I have to pay someone to do it. And it's a bit shit, but it is what it is. So my advice is to try and figure out if there's a workaround for your problem. So whatever it is that you're doing, maybe you're really good at presenting presentations, but you're not good at writing them. Can you outsource the writing part of the presentation? Mm. And also, what is your definition of crap? Because there are some people that have made a lot of money being crap at things. So keep that in mind. You might just be one of those people who, so for instance, there was this cafe in London where this guy who owned the cafe was just super rude to everyone, like really, really rude. And it became really famous. And you'd go in there specifically because this guy would like tell you to bugger off. And, you know, you'd complain that your toast was cold and he'd be like, tell someone who cares. And he ended up getting really rich from that. So I don't necessarily think that being crap at something is
a bad thing. Might be a point of differentiation.
You never know.
My thing, the first thing I would do is check in with someone who will be absolutely straight up with you and ask them whether you are actually as crap at that thing as you think you are, or whether you've simply set the bar too high. Because I think
like me, yes. with you three, Kelly and Kate and Chrissy, like, no, you are actually as crap at that as yeah. you think you
Kelly
are.
Kelly is really the least techie blogger I've ever come across. Or it's a close race between you and Darren Rouse, Woog. You know, pro blogger. Darren should know more about blogs, you know, more about the tech side than he does, but he doesn't.
Woog is worse than everyone.
Oh yeah, she's
terrible. Did I say that on the air? Did I tell that really funny story about how she logs into her blog?
No.
Oh, this is hilarious. So Woog, this is Kate Woog from Woog's World. The way she logs into her blog is by clicking on an email that Kelly sent her like 8 years ago and clicks on that link that Kelly created. That's how she gets into her blog. It's amazing.
Oh, that is amazing. That's Kate.
Yeah.
So those examples aside, chances are you are not as crap as you think. So then you have to make the decision, like this particular thing that you're talking about, do you put the time in to improve or not? And the way that I always come back to, I think the level of discomfort that you're willing to endure for something will tell you whether you're willing to put the time in or not. So I am willing to endure a lot of discomfort for writing. I'm willing to get up at 4:15 every day to do it. I'm willing to write thousands of really shit words in the pursuit of good ones. And if I wasn't willing to do that work, it would be clear to me that writing does not mean as much to me as I think it does. And interestingly, so for years and years, I was a triathlete. I did triathlon for 10 years and I actually thought I would be a triathlete forever. But it actually got to the point where improving at triathlon was taking so much work because, you know, I'd gotten to the point where I was just making incremental improvements for a lot of work. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to do the work anymore. And so as soon as I didn't want to do the work anymore, that's how I knew it was time to quit triathlon. So figuring out whether you should quit something or keep going with improving it, like I think you would probably already know the answer to that. Like either you want to push through the discomfort or you don't. And if you don't want to push through the discomfort, don't force yourself to, because you're not going to get there. And the other question you asked was kind of, how do you cope with failure or disappointment, not living up to the personal standards in the, you know, if you do decide to push on and try to improve? My answer to that is to practice self-compassion and also understand there's no such thing as failure, just learning. So you're never going to be great at anything without first pushing through the indignity of being a bit shit at first, and also the indignity of not meeting your own standards. But you also have to understand that the gap between aspiring to a certain level and actually getting to that level, like that gap never closes, because the better that you get at something, the more you realize how much better you could be. So you'll never get there. And if you Google Ira Glass, the taste gap, watch the Vimeo video and that will explain that concept a little bit better. So yes, so the next question is from Sarah, and she asked how we deal with the news. And she said, last night I found myself defending my watching of Housewives of Sydney as an antidote to current affairs. So, Carls, do you watch the news?
I do watch the news because Ben and I both work from home. We have it's our crossover from work into evening, and we turn the news on and kind of finish off our day watching the news. I tend to stick to SBS or ABC and skip mainstream news. It's a little bit less sensationalist and it's more even reporting. Also, go screen free. I think turning off all the things is one of the best things you can do. I've gone through many times how important it is to, I delete Facebook from my phone. That's actually one of the reasons why I don't participate in the group very much, because I block myself out of Facebook for most of the day. Although someone called me on it the other day.
What are you doing here?
Yeah, they're like, what? You said you're not on Facebook during the day. I was like, ah. But I had to log in because I was doing some work for, I'm explaining myself. I'm apologizing for being on Facebook during the day. So turn off all the things, turn Facebook off, because Facebook is actually the worst. Don't read news on Facebook. That's a bad place to get news. Get news from reputable sources in Australia, independent reporters, so SBS and ABC. I'd be wary of pretty much anything you read outside of those two places. And also, you never have to apologize for anything that you watch, ever. I have watched all 16 seasons of Degrassi, and I told everyone last week that I love tattoo disasters and age gap love. It's really all about varied interests. And if, you know, people are going to try and shame you for what you watch, just tell them to go fuck themselves. From me, say Carly says. Carly
says. Oh, how do I follow that? I don't watch the news, especially once I had kids. I just don't watch the news anymore. It's too depressing. The main reason I don't watch the news is because the only thing that is reported on the news are things that play on our fears or other high emotions. And this isn't
exactly.
This isn't actually the fault of the news. This is the fault of humans, because these are the things that we respond to. Like, we think we want, oh, wouldn't it be great if there was a news station that reported only on good news stories? The thing is, no, they've tried that. People have actually tried it and it's actually not worked, because we're not all that interested in good news stories. It has to be a high emotions good news story. And the only reason that high emotion good news stories resonate is because there are relatively few of them, because the vast majority of news reporting is fear-based. Yeah, if they tried to flip that around, like, people just wouldn't watch. So yeah, the fact is we're only mildly interested in good news. We're hugely interested in things that could potentially hurt us or that we need to be hyper aware of. So yeah, but having said that, even though I don't watch the news on TV, I'm still exposed to news via Facebook and via Twitter. Like Carly said, just be careful. I'm just very aware of what I'll click through to. So if the news source is, you know, the Batuta Advocate, which, by the way, is a satirical newspaper. So I've seen people quote that, like The Onion, like it's a real newspaper. It's not. But yeah, if it's, you know, if it's the Telegraph or the Daily Mail, I don't click, because I know that.
Or news.com.
Sorry, news.com.au, but no.
No.
They're not giving me a balanced opinion about anything. So I don't click through to them. If I do watch TV news, I have to admit, I do watch The Project, and I do enjoy The Project, which is a news show here in Australia. And because I feel like even when they're reporting on things that are fear-based, they do try to bring some level of balance to it, but they sit outside your usual nightly news 30-minute bulletin type of thing.
I enjoy The Project too. Yeah. I think sometimes when I'm feeling a bit lost on Facebook or social media, and I feel like sometimes I'll just be on social media and it just seems like a lot of people really like Trump, and it freaks me out, and I'll think, what is going on? And then I watch The Project and I'm like, oh no, these are my people. No, I understand now. Like it brings me back to reality.
That's it. And the thing is, people like Sarah and people like me who avoid the news and then feel we kind of have to justify our desire for doing so. I think it's perfectly valid to protect yourself from all the heartache. It's not like we don't know there's a lot of crap stuff going out in the world, but the fact is you're not doing the world a favor by feeling sorry for it or by existing in a state of constant high anxiety. So I just think do whatever you need to do to protect yourself while not being completely ignorant about what is going on a global scale.
Yeah, definitely.
So last question is Carla, and Carla asked about imposter syndrome. So where do you sit on imposter syndrome, Carls? I have very strong feelings about imposter syndrome.
I feel like a fraud pretty much every day, and that's why I'm such a huge advocate for conversation. I think when you open up a conversation, you realize that everyone feels like they're less alone and less fake and less invisible. Everyone feels this way, which is actually incredibly comforting. So I think that particularly even in workplaces, because workplaces can be so competitive, and even within blogging, that's been a huge eye-opener for me in the blogosphere, because when I first started blogging, bloggers didn't talk to each other because they were kind of in competition with each other. And then there were a few bloggers, particularly Nikki Parkinson from Styling You was actually one of the first bloggers that I knew that reached out to other bloggers and advocated for us helping each other and hanging out together and working on each other's stuff. And I now have a group of bloggers that I hang out with regularly, that includes Nikki. And it's such a wonderful group of people where I can go and say, oh, I'm feeling really awful about this thing and I'm feeling really awful about that thing. And it turns out that they're feeling really awful about it too. And it's just really lovely to have those kind of conversations where it's like, yeah, we all feel like useless pieces of shit. let's just sit around and go, yay, we all feel this way. But then you also get these beautiful, actually Kelly and I were talking about this before off air about the latest serial, and we were talking about, we won't ruin it because we're actually going to do an episode on it because it's so great. But there's a particular thing in this thing of serial where it just shows this one person from all these different angles. And I think that when you open up a conversation about something like imposter syndrome, you get to see yourself from your point of view and from other people's point of view. And it's always so different and so wonderful. And it's so valuable. So I think just communication and talking about that kind of thing, and also just admitting that you feel like a useless piece of shit, is very, very helpful. So do more of that.
Yeah. Now, I actually wrote something about this for Copy Blogger once, and I did a fair bit of research about it, and I'll link to it in the show notes. But imposter syndrome is actually a good thing because it means you're not delusional, and it's only completely delusional people who don't suffer from it.
That's true. Yeah, that's a great one.
It truly is. And I'm having to remind myself of this at the moment because I'm speaking at the Pro Blogger Conference this year. And when I got asked to speak, I was supremely flattered because I knew it was going to be a single stream. Yeah, not as many, I've spoken the last few years, but the last few years there's been like three streams and breakout sessions and panel sessions and all kinds of things going on. So it's been very flattering. And this year I knew it was going to be a much smaller lineup. I didn't realize how small the lineup was until
it's tiny
until just this week. And to see my face up next to Dan Rouse and Pat Flynn and Jada Selner and James Schranko, and then I feel like, and then there's me, and I'm like quietly freaking out, going, "Oh my god!" Like they've made a really big mistake.
But then in situations like that, you need to say that out loud, and then I say, you've been like such a positive voice in the blogging community for so long. You have published 3 very successful books. You have a very successful podcast. You have just as much right to be there as anyone else. And also you're a beautiful speaker as well. And people get so much stuff out of what you do. And that's why you need to put your hand up and go, I'm freaking out, so that people can go, Kami Farm, you're awesome and you should be there.
Aw, I'm going to cry. but yeah, and you know what? Like what I have learned is that, so I've just come back from a big tropical think tank conference, which is a similarly very, very small, very intimate conference in the Philippines. There's only 9 speakers. And from speaking to all those 9 speakers, I got the same vibe from them as well. Like all of them were kind of like, wow, I feel the pressure because this is like such a different, small, tiny, intimate conference. And I feel like being called up to be a speaker for this is a big deal and I've really got to deliver. And I look around at all the other speakers and go, what am I doing here? And so it's very comforting when people will admit that. So hopefully you guys are comforted by me admitting that because it's generally how I'm feeling, but I am having to go, it's good that you're feeling imposter syndrome, Kelly, because it means that you're not just going, well, yeah, of course I, you know, deserve to be up there with these guys because I'm amazing. Like it's good. It's just good to have humility. If you've got imposter syndrome, it's good that you've got humility. The only time that imposter syndrome becomes unworkable is when you let it hold you back from doing something. So feel the imposter syndrome. Be glad that you've got it because it means you're not delusional and you're not suffering from your narcissistic personality disorder, and then just get on with doing the thing that you've been asked to do, because if you've been asked to do it, there's a good reason that you've been asked. Thank you so much for listening to Straight and Curly. This week's show notes and links will be available at straightandcurly.com. We also have an incredible Facebook group full of fellow self-improvement junkies. So if that's you too, come join us at facebook.com/groups/straightandcurly.
And if you have any questions or weird self-improvement hacks you want us to trial, you can tweet us at Kelly Exeter or at Smaggle, or you can email us at hello@straightandcurly.com.
Jackrabbit FM.
For your ears.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.